Author Zadie Smith first captured the world's attention at 24 with her debut novel White Teeth, a dazzling portrait of modern London. Since then, she's become known not only as a novelist, with works such as On Beauty, Swing Time, and most recently The Fraud, but also as an essayist of remarkable range and subtlety. Her latest essay collection, Dead and Alive, brings together reflections on art, literature, politics, and everyday life. It's a book that moves from meditations on fellow writers such as Toni Morrison and Hilary Mantel to encounters with contemporary art and music to the changing face of her own Northwest London. Zadie Smith, you are very welcome to Arena.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's a wide-ranging collection in terms of subject matter. What connects these essays for you? Is there a guiding thread that draws them all together?
Interest. It's usually things that concern me that I'm engaged with. And also maybe in the title, I'm always interested in the difference between things in art, anyway, things that make you feel dead and things that make you feel alive. And I guess I'm on the side of writing about things that make me feel alive. So there's a lot of appreciation in the book.
The title suggests a kind of a tension between presence and absence. That's kind of played out in some of your explorations of artists and muses and writers and their legacies. What about the title itself, Dead and Alive? What does that mean to you?
Well, you know, I guess that's the teenage existentialist in me, that the most important definition in politics and social life and art is that one to me, the line between feeling dead and feeling alive, but also the line between being dead and being alive. You know, all of our struggles are about trying to extend the gap between being alive and dead as long as possible. That's where all our politics, all our ideas sit. So to me, it's like the fundamental line, yeah.
You're clear that this book is something that you want for the general reader and that in general that you write essays for a general reader. Maybe tell us a little bit about why that's so important to you.
I think, you know, when I was younger, you know, sometimes, like, particularly if I was in America doing readings, I'd notice that some of my peers of my age, you know, you go into a reading of theirs and everybody's 27 with a cool tote bag and they're all, you know, cute and cool. And I was 27. I go into my readings and there would be some 27-year-olds cute with tote bags. But there'd also be, you know, old ladies, young ladies, men, women, every color, every face, all kinds of people. And I used to think, oh, that's odd. And now I feel like I'm so grateful for it. Like, it's quite unusual, I think. And I'm aware of it. I'm aware that I'm not only talking to, you know, my type of people or my friends or my crew or my crowd. I'm aware that it's a wide audience because of White Teeth. And so I'm always trying to think of them and trying to, I guess, remember when I felt very much on the outside of literary culture and what kind of writers made me feel at home, like I could participate.
What kind of writers did make you feel at home at that point?
Well, there weren't many. You know, I got used to trying to make myself at home in places where I didn't belong, but the people who were close, I guess, I mean, they're not unusual names, but certainly Hanif Qureshi, Alice Walker, Toni Morrison. And that was partly identification, you know, a feeling of people who were near me. But also, you know, John Keats is one of my earliest, I don't know, inspirations. That's maybe a kind of class connection. I knew he was kind of outside of the mainstream. And then, you know, sometimes my husband, Irish poets, Heaney, people who had that voice which reached out to you.
Do you think that maybe one of those reasons that you do manage to reach such a general audience with the essays that you write is that frequently you write about the sort of things that perhaps, if you were to put essayists in quote, don't necessarily write about? You know, the films of Jordan Peele or Justin Bieber or Eminem?
But I mean, surely that kind of divide, I think that's kind of a 90s thing, right? Like feeling that kind of culture is not serious. I feel like we've had a good 30 years of seriously considering pop culture. I don't think I'm the only one who does that, surely. And I don't mean it as a kind of, oh, isn't this cute? I like Eminem or Jordan Peele. I mean, I really consider this work of the highest level, so it deserves criticism that meets it where it lives.
I'm interested in the book in particular in how it dissects how we make and consume culture, but also how we do that within a mostly online world. Your approach to the internet is it's a complicated one. How do you think that's affected how you write?
I think I try to be very straight about it in the book. Like, I am completely out of it. So being out of it only gives you a certain... There's many things I don't know and I can't possibly ever understand. I'm completely lost on, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously. But given that literally everybody is on, it might just be sometimes interesting to know what it's like to be off. Like, if you're curious about what it looks like from the outside, that's all that interests me, like a kind of designated driver. Like, what does the past, you know, whatever it's been now, almost 20 years, look like if you aren't fully in it? Because I think sometimes a little bit of distance can be helpful, right? Like, it can give you a perspective that isn't there when you're deep inside it. It doesn't mean it's the right perspective, doesn't mean it's correct or a judgment. It's just what I notice, because it is quite lonely out here on the outside. And you do, of course, notice huge changes in people around you. And it's not always clear whether they notice those changes in the same way. It's maybe hard to notice when you're in it.
Those observations, even I noticed to somebody like me, the moment I read them, they made complete sense to me. At one point you say that, you know, it's a clear fact that whenever I join a WhatsApp group, time warps. I end up seeing the people in that WhatsApp group about 80% less than I previously did, and yet I still seem to hear from them constantly.
That is literally the case.
Which is what happens to everybody.
It will happen to everybody. But again, it's not... To me, it's not a program, it's a description. Like, I have always said, when I'm thinking about adults, like, you know, you do you. I have no... Like, if that's what you want to do, then you do that. That doesn't really interest me that much about what people do with their phones and their screens, because they're grown adults and they're making their choices. But in that particular essay, which is about the internet, I was thinking about the boundary between childhood and adulthood and how actually kind of radically disruptive it is when we're dealing with this media to have not considered that boundary. Like, in every other media, in every other intoxicating substance, we always did consider that boundary, and it just struck me that we kind of ran ahead without having done that. And there are consequences to that. That's it. And I think we're far enough away that people can be a little more honest with themselves about that at this point.
Yeah, in that particular essay, and it's a really interesting point to make, you talk about children's backstage life, as you refer to it, and how they're being robbed of it, and that's something the parents might not necessarily think about often enough.
I think part of it was influenced when I was teaching for such a long time, particularly from like 2008 to 2020. I was obviously teaching people who had been, you know, 10 at the beginning of the century, and who, it's nobody's fault, but there were literally no guardrails. So I just don't think the adults were perhaps aware of what those children were doing in 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12. I don't think they knew. I could read about it because it's in their stories that they would give me, make your hair raise. But I just thought it's funny they had to deal with it all by themselves. They had to metabolize it by themselves. They had to decide how much they wanted in their lives by themselves. And they did. You know, they're a kind of courageous generation. They've gone through something which is pretty extreme in terms of what a childhood used to be and what it used to look like. And they're here. So it is, as I said in the essay, I think it's metabolizable. But the question is, if we did it again, which we're doing it again all the time, of course, would we do it a little differently this time, possibly?
There's a section of the book that you dedicate to writers who you've loved and who've since passed away. Can you tell us about what figures like Hilary Mantel and Toni Morrison meant to you, I suppose, both as a reader and as a writer?
Well, obituaries are interesting, of course, because they're not necessarily your favourite writers, but they are the writers who died on your watch, right? So it's the moment where you consider, oh, we've lost one of our cohort, one of our group, and what did it mean? So obviously I write, when I'm asked to write an obituary, I do write about people who meant something to me. Hilary was just an example of mastery. She had mastery at the level of the sentence, at the level of the story, and she was also a really incredible person. I didn't know her well at all, but she was very proud. She was very guarded. She was completely... she reminds me a bit of Sally, actually, your Sally Rooney, like born kind of ready-made. Like, you can't imagine anyone teaching either Hillary or Sally how to write. It's like a full... It's a full gift, and it was fully complete, and it didn't need any nudging or changing. It just was there from the start. And those kind of writers are incredibly rare, but they're impressive to the rest of us.
And about Toni Morrison?
Oh, well, Toni was a different... I mean, Toni, it's more like... Maybe I sometimes think it's hard for maybe readers or writers of a majority culture to imagine what it's like when you want to do something that's literally nobody. So for me, she was the black female writer. I didn't really know of any others when I was a kid. I mean, obviously, my knowledge grew and grew over time. But when she won the Nobel, particularly, that was a huge... it was a huge deal. It just made something possible in my mind. And I did actually meet her once, but I was too scared to talk to her. I sat next to her in a circle of writers backstage, and all I managed was nice shoes. I mean, there were nice shoes, but it's not what you want to say to the Nobel laureate.
It's better than nothing. That's not bad.
It's better than nothing. I just sat there completely tongue-tied. Yeah.
There are parts of the collection that are quite political. I was struck by how open you are to opinions changing and to accepting a fluidity of thought. It's something that's not altogether fashionable in some circles, is it?
Well, I guess not, but I'm trying always to be as honest as I can in the moment, and to consider my priorities, I guess, which are always kind of existential, socialist, and human. You know, there's the three things that are always kind of battling each other when I'm thinking. Sometimes one gets the advantage over the other. But again, I'm not, I don't feel like a polemicist, so I'm not trying to, convince anybody of anything. And I'm also not trying to belong to a community of people. I'm just trying to think. Yeah, I'm just trying to think. So I don't know. I do it as honestly as I can, you know, day by day. Not expecting to do it perfectly, but just to do it as I know how.
There is one moment that where you nudge an individual phrase in one of these essays that led me to think. It's the essay. It's written in 2019, and you talk about how we might feel differently about the term cultural appropriation if instead we saw it as interpersonal voyeurism. And you suggest that Write What You Know has started to become a bit more like stay in your lane. Do you think that discussion has changed in the 6 years since you wrote that particular essay?
Absolutely. But I guess what's really funny about pieces like that is that sometimes people come to me and go, I don't know why you bother writing an essay like that. You know, nobody thinks that anymore. And I'm like, yes, but you did. And of course, if people don't push back a little bit, then the argument stays in that place, right? Mm-hmm. So for me, that's the only essay I think I've ever written where I wrote a kind of defense of my people, my, I guess, identity group, my group being writers. And just trying to not even really defend, but to explain. Like, if you're curious about how it is we do what we do and why, these are some of the reasons. And you don't have, I think I said even in that piece, if that version of fiction is repulsive to you, then I honestly do think that kind of fiction will die, and I won't particularly weep for it. I mean, there's a wonderful tradition going back 2,000 years that I, you know, most of which I haven't read, so I'd be perfectly happy for it to stay there. But I know, not as a writer, but as a reader, I just read this extraordinary novel, for example, called Bug Hollow by an American writer called Michelle Hunnivan, about kind of three generations of a family in California, and I've been reading it for the past 2 days. And I wept, I was moved. I lived in this book. And there is no way that one person could know the great variety of people in that book, different ages, different genders, different life stories. I was so moved and I was so convinced. I have no idea how she did it. I don't know how someone writes a novel of that skill. I was humbled. But more than anything, I was just transported. And when I finished it, I don't know. I saw California differently. I saw those people differently. I thought about what it is to lose a child, which happens in the middle of that book. it did something to me, and it's that feeling that I'm defending and fighting for, because I know it to be transformative in myself. It's much more a defensive reading than writing. Writing, you know, writing I can take or leave, but I love being a reader.
I'm almost attempting to tie this up here. 2025 is the 25th anniversary of the publication of White Teeth. It was the book that catapulted you into the public eye. You said in a recent interview that you tried to read the book again for the anniversary, but you couldn't get past the first page. Why was that?
I just think, you know, I turned 50 2 days ago, and the person writing that book is 20, 21 when I started it. I defy anyone to go back to the journal or diary at 21 and read it with much enjoyment. Like, I have a really warm feeling towards it, like, wow, you go girl, or something like that. Like, what energy. But I'm a different person, and it's a different life, and my feelings about all kinds of things, like semicolons, for example, have changed so radically that it's hard for me to enter back into those pages. But I love especially when teenagers read it, because I think it's ideally a book for teenagers. And I love their enthusiasm, and I love remembering those people. Like, I feel so fondly about the people, Samad and Archie and Clara and all of them. I love those people. That's not the objection. It's just the sentences.
It's been brilliant talking to you tonight. It's been a joy. Zadie Smith.
Oh, so nice. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on to Arena.
Thanks. Bye.
Zadie Smith's new essay collection, Dead and Alive, is out now, and it's published by Penguin. And you're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. It's to film reviews. Now, this evening, we're exploring four new films. Begonia is an eco-satire set in Greece, a look at contemporary Romania in Continental 25. We'll also take a look at Kenny Dalglish, about the great Liverpool manager King Kenny, made by Asif Kapadia, and historical drama Palestine 36. I'm joined by film critic Tara Brady. Let's start in Greece. Begonia, directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, follows two young environmental activists who kidnap the CEO of a powerful multinational company. Their goal, to make her face the ecological destruction her corporation has caused. But as the three characters are trapped together, the lines between captor and captive start to blur, don't they always? Part thriller, part absurdist comedy, part moral puzzle, all 100% Yorgos Lanthimos. Tara, are you a fan?
I am a huge fan of the earlier ones. Yeah, like
you liked his earlier work. Okay.
I only like the earlier ones. No, I think Dogtooth is a masterpiece. I was not a fan at all of the last film, if you remember, Kinds of Kindness. It was a portmanteau, but it was a strange portmanteau in that it was almost 3 hours long. And at that point, it's like, is that not a television series that you've made? And it also was a little bit, to me, it felt like a bunch of provocations, like, oh, here's dead topless lady, without a lot of point to it, which is not at all what his earlier films were like. There was always a point, no matter how kind of dark, pitch dark the comedy was. There was always something to them. I think this one feels a little bit, it's better than Kinds of Kindness. That's the good news. But it does also feel a little bit like a doodle. I don't know if you remember way back at the start of the millennium, there was a big vogue of what was called Asia Extreme titles. Mm-hmm. And that out of that, we would have got Bong Joon-ho's Memories of Murder, and then he went on to make Parasite. And we would have had films like Park Chan-wook's Old Boy. And one of those films was a film called Save the Green Planet, called by a director called Jang Joon-won. So this is a rough remake of that, and in that film, it's the same basic plot. It's this kind of a kidnap caper, and in the Joon film, it's one of those kind of bungle kidnapping things where everything that could go wrong does go wrong. And exactly as you say, there's that a little bit of a touch of the Stockholm syndrome thing kicking in, and you're not too sure. And it's the basic idea is that these two conspiracy theorists have come in to kidnap the CEO, believing that they're an alien out to destroy the world. And that film is one of those films that like really kind of exists mostly for its big twist ending. But the big twist ending, in order order to get to the big twist ending, there's a lot of that kind of anarchic South Korean humor that you know,
it sounds like my sort of film.
Yeah, to jolly things along. This one is a lot sourer than Bungling, and again, as with Kinds of Kindness, it feels like there's stuff that's just there to be really violent. There's a particular subplot which I won't spoil, involving a local police officer who calls by, and that to me just felt kind of mean-spirited in a way that I don't think his earlier films were, even though they're always effectively about people in suffocating worlds, like shoving other people either figuratively or literally in some kind of box. But again, there's always a point to it. I really love Emma Stone as this kind of like super bitch corporate entity. And she's, I mean, I feel like the styling is a little bit of a wasted opportunity, because I think they could have really leaned in and done the whole Fox News, you know, Mar-a-Lago Botox blonde thing and really had fun with it. She's excellent, and Jesse Plemons is always excellent. So there's a lot of really, really good performances. I think the one that's slightly overlooked is a newcomer called Aidan Delbus, who is playing Jesse Plemons' accomplice. He's this kind of dim-witted cousin who's in on the plot. But the triumvirate is like, it's just super, but like and really, really excellent performances to sort of carry things along, almost.
Okay, let's take a clip from it. This is Emma Stone as Michelle and Vanessa Eng as Corey.
The 5:30 thing.
Uh-huh.
Look, I know you sent the email already, but I need you to let everyone know that they are free to leave at 5:30 from now on, starting today, okay? But do it in a way that's, you know, what we talked about.
Yeah, of course.
We need to send the message that we have a new culture here now, where people should, yes, of course, feel free to leave at 5:30 and be with their families. No one is going to be overworked like in the past. No more unpleasant incidents. But, of course, it's not compulsory. And obviously, if people still have work to do, they should absolutely stay and continue to work.
Yeah.
But it's not strictly enforced. Although, we still do want to meet quotas. So if we can do that with no pressure, just remembering, you know, we are running a business here, so let your conscience guide you kind of thing. Yeah? Good?
I'll definitely let them know.
Great.
Tara, why do you think Emma Stone enjoys working with Yorgos Lanthimos so much? There's that kind of online joke that, you know, she's one, or he's one film away from, you know, meeting her for a drink outside
yes.
work.
I imagine she enjoys winning Oscars with him. That's got to be a factor. I think I'd probably go for a drink with the person who won me an Oscar. They do work extraordinarily well together, and like this part is really tailor made for her, like because she can really sort of lean into that corporate persona and have that. She's incredibly sleek. She's one of really into sort of sex self-actualization, and she's always working out, and she's always doing things, and she has the like impeccable routine for beauty routine, all that kind of thing. Yeah. So she has a really good fun, and then like in the performance once she's kidnapped is really interesting, because she does that thing of pleading, being manipulative, switching between like modes that you would do if you were in survival mode, but in a really sort of underhanded way.
And in terms of visuals, because obviously for certainly his recent films and his English language features, visuals are always hugely important and usually quite innovative.
Yeah, there's like he has fun with that sort of corporate architecture, and then going to and then flipping between that and run down small town America with, you know, kind of flea pit dresses and horrible like chintzy furniture and run down barns and that sort of thing. So he has fun with that sort of very sort of white trash Americana, and then cutting between the corporate world, and that's a really nice contrast. But he also has like a couple of really big visual flourishes, in particular like the last sequence, which again I won't spoil, but it goes somewhere very unexpected, and then you get this incredible montage which to me is almost worth an extra star. It's a really, really interesting sequence.
Okay, in terms of stars then, where are we?
I mean, I just wasn't gone on it. I just felt it was very slight. There's really good things in it, but to me, it feels like a doodle. And that's 2.5.
Oh, 2.5. Okay. If you missed Sinead Egan talking to Yorgos Lanthimos, Emma Stone and Jesse Plemons on last night's Arena, you can listen back, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. Our next film couldn't be more different. It's Continental 25, and it's made by Romanian director Radu Yuda. This is a social satire about a bailiff who has a crisis of conscience when one of her evictees dies by suicide at the very beginning of the film. So tell me, where do we go with this?
Well, this is, if you're familiar with Radu Yuda's work, he is a provocateur, but he always has, there's always a point to his work. And you actually sort of really, really think about his work afterwards. He is just one of the most innovative filmmakers working at the moment. Everything he does is completely different from the last one. His most recent film was Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World, and it really was, as it says on the title, it really did make you think about where we're going with late capitalism and what we're doing with social media. And he has this scattershot approach to satire where everybody's going down, toxic masculinity, that's going down, everything is going down, and he's going to take everyone with him. And this is very much that sort of thing. It's a really, really great central performance by Esther Tompa, who's playing this bailiff who comes in and evicts this, you know, homeless man who's a former athlete, obviously fallen on hard times, who's been wandering around, who's just been wandering around the city collecting cans and scrap metal, and that's basically how he keeps himself together. And when they come along with the notice, what happens is he kills himself, and she has to live with the fallout of that. And she goes to her employer, and she's obviously expecting some kind of censor, and that doesn't happen. So then she keeps telling everyone the story over and over again. And everyone keeps going, well, it's not your fault. It's just, and you know, there's all these kind of sly notes all the way through. Like, she is working on behalf of a German multinational company. And they're actually demolishing the boiler where the man lived because they're building a hotel, because of course they're building a hotel. So, I mean, there's so much fun to be had with this.
There's a fair amount to be said in this film about middle-class guilt as well, isn't there?
Yeah, I absolutely loved the sequence where she's there. Well, I've got €2 for the Ukrainian refugees and €2 for UNICEF and where she's like
it's a lot of €2.
It's literally that old biblical idea of giving alms in order to ease your conscience. And there's also a terrific sequence near the end of the movie with a priest, which is just so rife with religious hypocrisy, very, very old-fashioned religious hypocrisy. So that's going down as well.
There's a kind of very gentle, slow unpicking of like Romanian and Bulgarian nationalism because of where it's set. It doesn't explain to you at the very beginning. It's set in a place called Cluj, which has this huge history of once being Bulgarian and has been Romanian since the beginning of the 20th century. And you only find this out quite slowly. It's very gentle about how it introduces that into the story, isn't it?
Yeah, there's this idea of, and again, that gets kind of bound up in the larger fabric of the film, this idea about interlopers. And there's a couple of little sly digs about it that even if you're not familiar with the situation, you will pick up. But there is obviously a lot of historical disputes around borders in that particular part of the world. And this is very much one of them. And there's also the fact that her identity is bound up with that. So she's slightly an outsider in the city in some sense. And she's also then acting on behalf of other outsiders. So there's a real sort of sense of alienation there that again, it's not shoehorned in. It's just very slowly threaded through in a really clever way.
Okay, how many stars are we talking here?
Oh, I love this film. This is 5 stars for me. I love this.
Okay, that is Continental 25. To a documentary now about one of the great football managers, in fact, dare I say, one of the greatest human beings ever. Can you tell where my allegiances lie? It is called Kenny Dalglish, made by the same director who brought us the brilliant Amy about Amy Winehouse and Senna about Ayrton Senna. Just in case, I'm obliged to say, for those not familiar with Kenny Dalglish, who is he and why is he worthy of a documentary treatment, Tara?
Well, Kenny Dalglish, I presume people, most people are not old enough to remember Roy of the Rovers, but he's just the absolute perfect footballer, because he's one of the rarest of things. He's a player manager. I mean, how many people became as good of a manager as they were as a player, and could also sometimes even get up off the bench and score the winning goal? I mean, that was so, and he already had this enormous talismanic presence and importance in Liverpool, but he was also very, very much, and that's his adopted city. He's Glaswegian originally, and his first team was Celtic, and he made huge waves there, and then he basically is brought into Liverpool to replace departing Kevin Keegan, who goes off to Germany and gets beaten the next time he meets Liverpool, which is also in the film, a very nice moment. But at Liverpool, there's obviously all the silverware, but there's also, he serves a really important function after Hillsborough, and also after Heysel, but definitely after Hillsborough. He becomes this kind of chief mourner, and he becomes like a voice for the people who died, and also a real comfort to the families. And he would have been very instrumental in making sure like that the players were all there at the visiting hospitals, like and seeing really, really, you know, terrible things. And you know, he's been at all of the ceremonies since, and so he has that kind of gives a huge amount of emotional heft to the film, because it's still a really hard thing to talk about. It's still a really hard thing to look at. It's very much played down by Asif Kapadia. He obviously acknowledges it, and it is part of the film. But he does love his Roy of the Rovers sequences. He does love his like amazing strikes. He does love like dwelling on the fact that this is a big-hearted film about a very big-hearted person, and he's a really decent family guy. He's a really good sense of humor, and it's all of those things come through the film. It's a lovely film. It's a really nice film to hang out with.
Who do we get to see on screen here? What sort of talking heads do we have, or is it mostly just Kenny?
Well, as you know, like as with Amy and the Maradona film, and also Senna, the way that Asif Kapadia works is he works with archive footage. That has proved really brilliant for him, because like all of those are kind of the definitive documentaries about those subjects. And one of the things that is really good here is that he uncovered some like unseen footage from that no one's seen for years from Celtic, which is like the early part of the film, and it's really extraordinary. But you know, yeah, there's a great stash of stuff on Liverpool, but there's also then people who are really good talking heads, because Kenny was part of a triumvirate of Scotsmen that were huge in Liverpool, one of whom is Alan Hansen, the other one is Graham Souness, both of whom who go on to have deservedly very, very distinguished careers as commentators, and who were very good readers of the game, and who were very funny. So you're really not short of good commentary here.
Okay, how many stars are we talking?
Oh, four.
Four stars. Okay, finally we're finishing off with Palestine 36, directed by Anne-Marie Jacquier. What is this film? Tell us a little bit about it, Tara, to begin with.
So this is kind of, there's a big vogue at the moment in sort of going back and looking at the British in Palestine after the war, and during the 30s and past that period. And you would see past that period, for example, in Michael Winterbottom's Shoshana, and also in Sherry and Dabby's All That's Left of You. So there's a lot of people going back, and it's basically asking the question, how did we get to where we are today? And this is a huge part of the puzzle, because you do have, as there are several historical characters here, including Robert Arameo, who's playing Ord Wingate, who was a very big figure in British colonialism, was a veteran of Burma, and who was a fanatical Zionist, and as and you and you So you have these kind of figures threaded throughout this, like real life figures, including Liam Cunningham is here, who's playing who's a Derry born Charles Tagent, who was from the Raj. So there's an awful lot of figures from this larger British imperialist project that from all over the world who gather at Palestine at this particular moment in the mid 1930s, and the fallout is quite devastating, and the impact of what's happening is quite devastating, and you start to see a bombing campaign, and you start to see people fighting back. Some of the sort of invented characters I don't think are as successful as some of the historical characters that are represented, and I think part of the thing is that this film is just hugely ambitious. You kind of feel like it might have been better off as a long form TV show, because they're really trying to shoehorn in as much stuff as possible. So, you know, you've got the first Zionist settlements, you've got the Arab revolt, you've got the first broadcasting station in Palestine, you've got all of these events. So they're really, really, she's really trying to fit, the writer-director is really trying to fit an awful lot in here, maybe a little bit too much.
Okay, how many stars are we talking?
3.5. It's worth considering the moment. It's really impressive thing, but I felt it was a little bit crowded. Even Altman didn't always do Altman-esque brilliantly, you know?
3.5 stars to finish out with that, Tara Brady. Thank you so much. Begonia, Continental 25 and Palestine 36 are all in cinemas now. Kenny Dalglish is also in cinemas, and it'll be on Amazon Prime Video from November 4th. Down Cemetery Road was the debut novel by Mick Herron in 2003 and has now been adapted for the small screen by Apple TV. Emma Thompson stars as Herron's sardonic private investigator Zoe Boehm, and Ruth Wilson plays Sarah Trafford, an Oxford art restorer whose curiosity around a house explosion and the subsequent disappearance of a child drags her deep into a world of shadowy forces. Chris Wasser has seen it. He joins me in studio. Chris, this is linked to Slow Horses through Mick Herron being the author and Morwenna Banks being the screenwriter as well. Do you think the people at Apple TV are rubbing their hands together in gleeful expectation?
Oh, absolutely, because Apple TV Plus, even after, you know, however many years they've been out, they're still quite small in the streaming wars. I think something around like 40 to 50 million subscribers, and you put that next to Netflix's 250 million, you know, they have an awful lot of catching up to do. So the closest thing they've had to a proper global hit has been Slow Horses, to the point where they've been renewing, you know, this fifth season has just finished. Long before it aired, a sixth one was renewed, and then a seventh. So Slow Horses, starring, you know, Gary Oldman as Jackson Lamb, you know, and set in this world of purgatory spies basically doing the jobs that the James Bond types don't want to, has been an enormous success for them. So they must have gone back to Mick and said, what else have you got? Well, he's got something pretty good, the Zoe Boehm series, of which there are three, maybe four novels. And you're right, they came before the Slow Horses tale. And I think, you know, it was only right that they'd go into the writing room on Slow Horses and they'd spot one of the most talented writers in there, Morwenna Banks, and said, let's, you know, build this series around Zoe. And Zoe is this private investigator who is married to a private investigator who's forced to step in and investigate this case after, let's just say, her husband takes a back seat. But it's actually telling two stories. So you're telling Zoe Boehm's story, but also Sarah Trafford. So we're in Oxford. We focus first on Sarah's story. She's an art restorer with, you know, who obviously has, you know, an eye for detail, which will come in handy when she decides to become an amateur investigator, basically. We first meet her when she is preparing a dinner for her slippery husband, let's say Mark, played by Tom Riley. He's in finance. He's trying to impress this awful client, a potential client. And in more ways than one, the dinner party gets quite explosive because the next door neighbor's house blows up and everyone's out in the street and asking questions. And, you know, the first reports that come in say it was a gas leak, you know, and two adults have been killed. A small child has been in hospital. But when Sarah the next day, for no apparent reason, and this is a bit of a jump and we'll come back to that, decides to deliver a get well soon card to the child, she discovers that, you know, the child isn't actually in that hospital. You know, she's greeted with quite a bit of hostility. And when she goes home to look at the report, she discovers that the child is now missing from reports about that explosion. So that sends her down a path where she ends up knocking on a private investigator's door and says, I want to look into this.
She doesn't just knock at their door. She accidentally falls into their doorway. Yeah. Which is another small jump.
Yeah, That's where she meets Joe first, played by Adam Godley. I like Joe. I mean, this series is all about Zoe Bone, played by Emma Thompson. But I love Joe because he's this guy who always wanted to be, you know, a PI and fancies himself as a, or even fantasizes about himself becoming this Philip Marlowe character. But he's more like Paddington Bear, let's be honest.
Okay, let's take a clip. This is Zoe Bone at the private detective agency that she and her husband Joe run together, Emma Thompson and Adam Godley, playing Zoe and Joe.
Actually, what I was thinking was this house explosion could be a bit of a cash cow.
In what way, exactly?
Well, due diligence. Maybe the gas company didn't do it.
Maybe this case could go all the way to the top.
Well, maybe sort of all the way to the middle. The bottom of the middle. Middle of the bottom.
Joe.
No? Anyway. I might do a bit of sniffing around.
Oh, God, when did you last sniff around these? Spring?
I haven't had time to do laundry. Been working on a divorce case.
Where do I sign?
For a client.
Is it another desperate damsel in search of a knight in shining Cardi?
Maybe.
They have an unusual relationship, don't they?
They really do. I do. I love Joe. I don't really love the way that what the series does with his character, but I won't get into that. But he is he's very gentle. He's the sort of character who, when a new client walks into the office, despite the fact that they have terrible money problems, you know, their clients haven't been paying them. They haven't eaten for days. He still welcomes a potential client with, you know, biscuits and tea, and sits down, listens to their story, and thinks this is going to be the one. This is going to be the one that makes his name and maybe potentially makes his fortune. And he's always keeping flowers by the side of the desk for his wife, but unfortunately she doesn't really look like, or she doesn't look at him like that anymore. You know, they haven't just run out of money, they've between them run out of love too. And Emma Thompson's Zoe at the beginning, she seems to enjoy almost like politely torturing him, saying, you know, oh, we're not that kind of couple anymore. And she lets him know that she's going out to be with someone else. So they do have a very interesting relationship. But as I say, I won't spoil exactly what happens to Joe, but he does have to take a back seat in order for Zoe to kind of reassess that marriage, that union, and also the business that they're in.
Okay. The other part of the story that happens is when, it's very early on in the first episode, we find out that Sarah is actually onto something, and the action moves to the Ministry of Defence and a meeting between somebody referred to only as C and Hamza Malik. Let's have a listen to that.
I don't remember you receiving permission to start a war in Oxford.
Yeah, the department was given carte blanche, sir.
Carte blanche? Well, that does suggest pretty wide parameters, I'll grant you. Not wide enough to cover barely controlled explosions in densely populated university towns. Who do you have running this one? Wile E. Coyote?
Well, our man on the spot is,
A trigger-happy twat. I assume the incendiary was his idea.
It was a field decision, sir.
Oh, was it a field decision, Mother?
Yeah.
Well, I would love a heads-up on what wreck-it-fucking Ralph has planned for an encore.
He needs to dial it back just a smidge, doesn't he?
He really does, yeah. I mean, it's
he's great.
You know, and this is where the similarities lie between Down Cemetery Road and Slow Horses, where you have, you know, these scrappy bad guys who've made an awful mess for themselves and they need to clean up and cover up their mistakes. And then you've got these plucky, you know, amateur good guys who are trying to redeem themselves and who keep coming up against all of these threats. And, you know, they don't care. They're going to just try and save the day, even though they might, you know, stumble. And then you've got, you know, people like C there, played by Darren Boyd, who just, he's the type of guy that when he's insulting his lackey, played there by Adil Akhtar, it's 5 minutes later and you're going, did that insult make sense? I've never heard that swear word before. And then on the other side of things, you have a central investigator played by Emma Thompson. You know, look, if you watch the first episode and you're wondering where Emma Thompson is, just be patient. This series does require a bit of patience. She does show up in the second because the first is all about, you know, establishing Sarah's character. There is a kind of a similarity between herself and Jackson Lamb in that, you know, she can be a little bit rude. She can be a little bit flippant towards, you know, new clients and the people that she works with. She does skip showers. You know,
and, I was going to say not great with the personal hygiene.
With the personal hygiene. That seems to be a big thing with Mick Herron. But I quite liked her. She could be Jackson Lamb's sister. A lot cooler than him, actually. I love when the two, when Sarah, Ruth Wilson, Sarah, that is, and Emma Thompson, Zoe, when they come together. Later on in the series, when they initiate their own investigation and they realize that they really do need one another, that's when it really kicks things up a notch. Like, I love this idea that they are two brilliant women trying to clean up, you know, this mess caused by a dozen incompetent men. You know, and when every time they get close to something, they have those very violent, dangerous men trying to silence them. I think the series made by Morena Banks and directed by Natalie Bailey, it's really onto something there. The heart of that drama is what kept me watching, because there are some speed bumps. There are a lot of cliches. I mean, as you say, you know, see the villain there. I do like that you know who the villain is up front. I know that you know, here's the bad guys, watch them squirm as the good guys, you know, close in on them. But we've kind of seen that kind of thing before. Done better in Killing Eve, done better again for the millionth time in Slow Horses. There are too many cliches in there, Rick.
Okay, I want to take one more moment from this. This is Ruth Wilson's character, Sarah. And she's at the local hospital trying to deliver that card to the child who's been injured in the explosion. And then she accidentally runs in to the arrogant financier from her dinner party, Gerard, who's played by Tom Goodman Hill.
You make that all by yourself?
Actually, Gerard, Wigwam's little boy made it for Dinah Singleton.
Who? Doesn't ring any bells.
After the blast, we saw that child wrapped in a red blanket. I thought she might be here, but I've just been stonewalled by paediatrics.
Yeah, well, I know a few bods on the board of trustees.
Oh, what a surprise.
And I'm sorry, but they can't dish out info willy-nilly to every nosy neighbour.
I was just doing something nice for an orphan child who survived an explosion. Maybe you could ask your bods on the board if she's all right.
I thank you for dinner. Food was to die for. Almost literally.
Okay, the big question here is, if you are somebody who has been and watched Slow Horses and loved it and hear Mick Herron's name on this, do you think that that sort of person is going to like this?
I think so. Look, it's not as good, you know, straight out the gate, it's not as good as Slow Horses. You know, it does get a bit bumpy. It is a bit long in places. Again, for the millionth time, I'm thinking to myself, do we really need to, you know, cross that 50-minute mark in the episodes? We don't. But I love Ruth Wilson. She's a performer who just elevates, you know, even the most ordinary scripts. And there are times here where you're thinking, this could be reined in. She's brilliant to watch, brilliant with Emma Thompson. Sometimes I did think to myself, is Emma Thompson just playing an exaggerated version of herself here? Emma Thompson is one of those performers that does never really truly disappears for me, but that's okay because I quite like the character of Zoe. So it's worth sticking with for the two of them, but just be prepared for, you know, it's nothing is as good as Slow Horses, Rick, and I don't think anything ever will be, but it's a nice companion piece.
Oxford does its part in this as well. It looks beautiful for the setting of a show like this.
It really does, and I was only there a couple of months ago, so I kind of, you know, it's one of those shows where you're kind of pointing out things to yourself. I was there. But it also paints a very kind of cozy picture of the UK to the point where I think they might be kind of saying, this isn't, you know, the rest of the country isn't quite like this. If it can dial back the cartoonish elements, yeah, it definitely is worth sticking with.
Okay, there's 3 episodes out of 8 available, if I have that right.
First 2 are available to stream this week, but again, it's like Slow Horses, it's kind of one a week, and you know what, that's probably for the best sort of mystery like this.
Keep us hanging around. Will you keep watching?
I will, yeah. Again, it's for Ruth Wilson, because again, she is one of those performers who, you know, you watch her, she's good enough, her performance here is good enough to paper over the narrative cracks.
And stars?
3.
3 is good enough for me. Chris Wasser, thanks for joining us tonight. For the week that's in it, we want to remind listeners that RTE's supernatural drama The Unreal is back for a new season. This time, the Kelly family visits a spooky rundown hotel to attend an 80s video collector's fair when the young Kevin catches glimpses of a ghostly boy on his camera phone and the whole family get to go ghost hunting. It kicks off on Sunday on RTE1 at 5:10, and the little people in your home will be happy to hear all of the episodes will drop onto the RTE player in time for Halloween. And that is tonight. Tonight's Arena, produced by Sian O'Gorman. Paula Shields was our researcher. Broadcast coordinator Ollie Hamilton and Niall McMonagall was on sound. We are back tomorrow night with a 1-hour Halloween special. And I'll talk to you tomorrow night from 7.